and gentlemen, friends.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
Be as gods, you know,
catapult of propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Garrett Gilbert.
One of the things I find most interesting about waking up each day is that the older I get, the more I realize there's still a lot more to learn. Welcome to View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. I mean that no matter how much we try to understand what's going on in the world around us, if you really apply your mind, it's almost impossible to get bored. At least I think so. Or maybe I was just created that way. And that's why I really appreciate the opportunity to interview and talk to people who I think have interesting things to say. And that's why the last 5 years or so at the prophecy conferences that Sharon and I have been blessed to attend, I have happily volunteered to talk to the other speakers at the conference, because we get some really interesting and intelligent people who don't often gather in one place. And so over the next few months, we'll continue spinning out these interviews as we lead up to the release of the DVD set, the official conference DVD set from the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference. 53 presentations plus more than two dozen interviews, one-on-one interviews with all of the speakers at the conference. And I'll be bringing those to you on Wednesday nights, God willing. Don't know that my schedule won't get interrupted between now and mid-October, but that's my goal anyway. Tonight, couple of young men, well, one young man and his father, who's very proud of his son, who brought some really interesting stuff to the conference. Avi Lipkin has been a popular conference speaker for years. He's drawn on his knowledge and understanding of history to project into the future, specifically what might be happening geopolitically and prophetically in the Middle East. But his son has taken a real interest in ancient history and is applying modern technology to unraveling the riddles of the past. So, today on A View from the Bunker, Avi Lipkin and Aaron Lipkin. Modern technology is helping us learn things about ancient historical sites, and especially ancient sites of worship that we never would have known before. And our guest now is one who is using modern drone technology to help illuminate how some of these sites were used, and specifically the differences between how they were used by the Israelites coming into the land of Canaan and the Canaanites who were pushed out before them. He's an expert on the Holy Land because he's been working as a tour, well, arranging tours for visitors to Israel for more than, for about 20 years now. Is that correct? About 20 years? And especially looking at the holy sites of Hebron, Bethel, Shiloh, and Mount Ebal. We welcome Aaron Lipkin.
Good to be here.
We should have had the camera rolling during our discussion before we started the interview, because some of the stuff that was coming out was really good. Your work in tourism, what was it that led you to begin focusing on these holy sites, you know, Shiloh and Bethel, the sites where the tabernacle resided before finally coming to rest in the Temple Mount?
Yes. But first of all, the love of Bible. I'm so connected to the Bible. I remember as a child, my parents bought me this, you know, Bible for the children with pictures, and I read it so much, and I loved it. I felt that it was part of my history, part of my legacy as a Jew. And living in Israel even made it more stronger, the connection with the Bible. I was born and raised in Jerusalem, and at a certain point, after getting married, we moved to Samaria, which is the biblical heartland of Israel.
But kind of part of the West Bank now, correct?
Yeah, it's what is so-called West Bank.
Right, so-called, right.
And living there, you know, driving from Ophra, where I live, to Jerusalem, passing by the site of Jacob's dream of the ladder, passing by the place where Elisha, the servant of Elijah, brought the bears out of the forest, passing by Michmash, where Jonathan, the son of King Saul, fought the Philistines. This is like a 30-minute drive, and you're going through the Bible. You're swishing through the Bible. It's just amazing. And so I'm really submerged where I live, where I organize the tours. I'm submerged in the Bible, and that's great.
You know, and for a while in my broadcast career, I worked in Philadelphia, and every day I drove through Valley Forge, and I thought it was cool seeing the spot where George Washington and the troops survived that rough winter, but that's nothing compared to this. This is amazing.
Yeah.
So you've been using drone fitted out with cameras.
Yes.
To examine these sites. What have you discovered? What has been the most surprising thing that you found?
I have to first talk a bit about Professor Zeltal, Professor Adam Zeltal, who passed away just a half a year ago. You have to remember that the academic world, what's being taught in the universities is that the Bible is a fairy tale.
Right.
That it never happened, that the stories that are being described in the Bible are not historical facts, but just, you know, made up stories that were made up late in later periods of time. I was born and raised in Jerusalem, in Israel, in the Holy Land, and I was told by my Bible teacher at school that the Bible is a fairy tale, that all the stories are taken from other nations and changed in a monotheistic way. Multiply that by hundreds, thousands, millions of students in Israel and all over the world, and what you get is two generations that are detached from the Bible, that are detached from the belief in God, detached from the moral teachings of the Bible. And this is where we are today, a big crisis in identity. And for me, I met Professor Adam Zeltal, someone who is from the academic world. And you see this professor saying, I'm sorry, but the Bible is true. I surveyed the biblical heartland of Israel. I surveyed Samaria. I found hundreds and thousands of Israelite sites from the period described in the Bible. I found an altar on Mount Ebal, an Israelite altar, Joshua's altar. I found this really weird footprint formations in the Jordan Valley in Mount Ebal that I'm going to talk about. And so when I heard these things, I said to myself, I have to publicize it. I have to spread this world all over, this discovery all over the world. And when I looked at the footprint discovery, the footprints that Professor Adam Zeltal found, I said to myself, the only way that we can show it is if we use a drone, if we use aerial shots. And I'm sure that the audience will really enjoy the aerials that I took of these footprints.
Now, the footprints, were we talking human footprints? Are these things that could not have been made by human? What did you discover?
Okay, so Professor, here's the problem. The reason why it was taught that the Bible is not true, that the stories are not historical facts, are not historical events, is because there was no real evidence to show Israelite presence in the land
right. From
such an earlier period.
Right.
And after the Six-Day War, after 1967, there was suddenly a chance, an opportunity to come and to discover and to research Samaria thoroughly and really check what the situation is archaeologically. And Professor Adam Zeltal surveys Samaria from the 1970s all the way to just recently, just before he passed away. And what he finds, among other things, are mysterious footprint formations that are huge, they're humongous, from the Israelite period, dated off the bat, you know, from the Israelite period through clay and carbon, mm-hmm. 14. And the question is, what are they? I mean, they're so big. They're all footprint shaped, right footprint.
Mm-hmm.
What were they used for? Why did the Israelite come to so much trouble to build them? Why? Where do they appear in the Bible? These are all questions that arose from his discovery. Six footprints in the Jordan Valley, going up to the Tirzah Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Last one found around the altar of Joshua.
Does it trace out a path?
The path, the places that they were found, make Professor Adam Zeltal believe that is the way that the Israelites expanded into the land. We read in the book of Joshua that Joshua came in through the Jordan River,
mm-hmm.
and he immediately went on to conquer Jericho and the city of Ai. However, the archaeological evidence shows that the residence of the Israelites was not in that area. There was not enough archaeological evidence to prove the stories of Joshua conquering Jericho. But there were a lot of evidence from a bit north of Jericho, going up to the Tirzah Valley, ending in the area of Shechem,
mm-hmm.
of Nablus. And so Professor Adam Zeltal believed that was the beginning of the settlement of the Israelites in the land.
Hmm.
There was a strategic war effort by Joshua in the area of Jericho.
Yeah.
But a settling movement of the Israelites a bit to the north, of the area of the city of Adam, through the Tirza Valley up to Shechem and into the heart of Samaria.
Hmm. And many of those people groups that he encountered, when you read the book of Joshua, were declared by Yahweh to be Karem,
right.
Utterly destroyed.
Right.
Kill all the people, kill their livestock, burn everything, don't take any booty, don't take any of their stuff. It's all to be destroyed.
Exactly. And the question is, why the shape of a footprint? And
yes.
One of the things that Professor Adam Zaptal said is that it says in the book of Joshua, God says, every word that you will put your foot in will be yours.
Hmm.
That is what is one of the reasons why it is in the shape of a footprint. It's a declaration.
Hmm.
It's a flag saying, this is ours. God promised this place to us. That's why it's in the shape of a footprint.
That's fantastic. Now, not wanting to recover what you're going to talk about in your presentation, because viewers will see that on the DVD set anyway, I wanted to ask you about the differences in worship. You were talking and telling me before this interview that Canaanite worship on mountains was different from Israelite worship. And we know that holy mountains have played a key role in human history going all the way back to Eden, which was described in Ezekiel 28 as the holy mountain of God.
Right.
The Temple Mount, of course, is where he will reign forever. What was different between the way Israelites approached worshiping on a mountain and the way the Canaanites did it?
So when we read the Bible, what we see are levels of presence, of Israelite presence in the land. The first layer is the layer of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We're talking about a period that is parallel to the pagan Canaanite way of worshiping. And what we read in the Bible is that the Canaanites would worship their gods on the top of the mountains and under every fresh tree. And so these are the unique characteristics of Canaanite worship. That's the period of the patriarchs. When we go to the later period of the entrance of the Israelites and the presence of the Israelites in the land, that's the book of Joshua on, what we see, and this is very interesting, is that when Professor Adam Zaltal finds the altar from the time, the period of Joshua, he discovers it, by the way, accidentally, on Mount Ebal. Now, you would expect to find the altar on the summit, on the
right.
peak of Mount
right.
Ebal. But what happens is that he finds it on the slopes of the mountain.
Hmm.
Have you visited Shiloh? Or you,
I have not had the opportunity to visit Israel.
People have to come to Israel. It's really, it's just amazing. It's just, it really connects you to the Bible physically, literally.
Mm-hmm.
When you go to Shiloh, ancient Shiloh, you see that the area that where the tabernacle stood is outside of the city, and on the slopes of the city. It's not on the top of the city. So again, you find a site that is Israelite from the second layer, the time of the Israelites coming into the land, that is on the slopes and not on the peak.
Mm.
And the theory is that Joshua really wanted the Israelites to disconnect from pagan worship, from the Canaanite traditions. And so one of the things that he did was to detach himself from the peak and to go to the slopes, saying, this is not where we want to worship God. We want to worship God on the slopes.
Mm-hmm.
When you look in Jerusalem, when you're standing on Temple Mount and you're looking around you, you are surrounded by higher mountains.
The Western Hill, the one that's called Mount Zion today, is taller by about 80 feet.
And the Mount Scopus Ridge, the Mount of Olives, they are higher
yes.
than Temple Mount.
Yes.
So Temple Mount is lower.
Lower.
So again, another site from the time of the Israelites that is lower than the rest of the area.
Well, and this is fascinating to me because, again, in Ezekiel 28, I'm confusing with Isaiah 14, but the verses where he says, "You said I am a god, I sat in the seat of the gods," that describes Eden. So it is Ezekiel 28. That was where Adam and Eve walked with God until they disobeyed His command, and we were basically kicked off the mountain, kicked out of the seat of the gods. Perhaps the reason for the tabernacle on the slope is that our time to return to the top of the mountain is not yet.
It's a process.
Yes, and we will get there someday, but not yet.
Amen.
Well, Aaron, how do people find out more about your tours? I assume you talk about these things when you take people around and show them these sites?
Yeah, well, first of all, unfortunately, because the media coverage of the area of Judea and Samaria is very, I would say, either bias or a very specific, what it shows is the terrorist attacks and the problems and the violence that people think that Judea and Samaria are a war zone.
Yeah.
And I'm here to say it's not. I bring hundreds of thousands of tourists to Judea and Samaria. They go out of Judea and Samaria safely, experiencing a real amazing experience of connecting to the land, connecting to the stories of the Bible. And I think that is the uniqueness of what I do, of the travel agency that I had, bringing people to the biblical heartland of Israel, where all these stories happened. When I speak to sometimes the pastors and to tourists that visited Israel, they say, "Yeah, I've been in Israel 17 times." So I ask them, "Have you been to Hebron? Have you been to Shiloh?" They look at me and they say, "No." I say, "How can you visit the Holy Land? How can you visit the land of the Bible and not visit those places, the places that are so important in the Bible?"
Hebron, where David first became king. Yes.
Yeah. Where the patriarchs were buried, the tomb of the patriarchs. Beth El, the place where Jacob joined the dream of the ladder. Mount Ebal and the altar. These are so important. Not just for the identity, the Jewish identity, but also for the Christian identity.
Right.
This is the lineage of Jesus. This is where he came from. This is his connection to the Bible, to God. And so I invite everyone to come and experience these amazing places.
So how do people find you on the web?
Yes, yeah, so our website is www.lipkintours.com. We also have the DVDs that we just did, two DVDs about the site of Jacob's Dream of the Ladder and the footprint formations that I spoke about. We're going to do two more, hopefully by the end of this year, about the altar of Joshua and Mount Ebal and ancient Shiloh. We have tours during the year. If people want to come and volunteer in Israel, harvesting grapes, as it says in Isaiah 61, verse 5, we also have a special program for that.
Wow.
See you soon in Israel.
Yeah. Aaron Lipkin, Lipkin Tours. Just imagine that. I mean, we Americans will get emotional when we visit sites like the Alamo or Gettysburg, but carry that back about 3,000 years and the significance of those sites in Israel. Whew. At the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference, I'm Derek Gilbert. At the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference with one of the clearest voices who's been warning about the threat posed by violent Islam. Notice I say violent and not radical, because violent Islam is not radical, it's mainstream. Avi Lipkin, author of 7 books, most recently Islamic Rivalry. Avi, good to see you again.
Great to be with you again.
As we record this on the 15th of July, 2016, of course, last night we were greeted by the news that an Islamic terrorist drove a truck through a crowd gathered for Bastille Day in Nice, southern France, 84 people dead, perhaps more yet to die from their injuries. Would you concur that violent Islam is not radical, but it is in fact mainstream?
Completely correct. Islam is a conquering, triumphalist religion, and there are two ways to do it. One, of course, is what they call the moderate Islam, which is through money, through the buyout of politicians, media, factories, economical things. Those people who have a tendency towards violence are going to find they will find the fulfillment of their lives by committing suicide and taking people with them. Very correct. One other thing I wanted to say also is that I live in Israel half the year I'm in the United States. In Israel, we had a spate of car rammings, in which terrorists would drive cars into groups of civilians, groups of soldiers. Israel's answer, they put up cement blocks or cement columns at the bus stops, anywhere where people would congregate. So I would say to the people in Nice, France, is one of the things they're going to have to do now is their whole beachfront, and it can be done in a pretty way. Mm-hmm. Put up like metal, not metal, put up concrete pillars or mm-hmm. you know, little pillars, something which would stop a truck from being able just to ram and ram mm-hmm. and ram. The French have to wake up to the fact that their population is now more than 10 or 15% Muslim.
There are now more practicing Muslims in France than there are practicing Roman Catholics.
Yes. By the way, in England, there are more mosques than there are churches mm-hmm. now. I think it's one of the reasons why the British pulled out of the European Union. The right. whole Brexit question is that the English are losing their country, and they finally now awakened to that. Mm. France is also awakening to it. Italy is awakening to it. The Eastern European countries that used to be part of the Soviet bloc, which are now part of the European Union, they've been against the Islamic immigration into their countries from day one. And, you know, Angela Merkel and all these leaders of Western Europe say, oh, you have to take in your quota of Muslim suicide bombers mm-hmm. Because it's good for the economy. So I understand where she's coming from. They say like this, if 99% are hardworking people, it's good for the German economy. If 1% are terrorists, then we'll deal with it. But 1 million Syrians went into Germany. If 1% are terrorists, that's 10,000 terrorists.
Right.
In the United States, 19 terrorists shut down the United States on 9/11.
Mm. One of your talks is, I think, given the context of what we're talking about here, might surprise some people. I think we Americans know very little about Islam in general. We tend to view Islam as this monolithic religion. They all believe the same thing, when in fact there are a number of sects and divisions within those sects. There's Sunnis and Shias and then various groups within that. One of your talks this weekend is on the fall of Saudi Arabia to ISIS. How can they be fighting against each other?
Well, it's like this. If you're a young Saudi Muslim kid and you go through the Wahhabi mosque system in the schools, when you graduate, you are a soldier ready to go into battle. And so what the Saudis do is they export all these kids. They want to get rid of them, basically.
Sure.
Because after what they've learned in these schools, they're going to overthrow the kingdom. So what they do is the Saudi government gives them a stipend or a grant and says, okay, now you go to Afghanistan or Syria and you wage jihad for Allah. And these guys go off to war, and some of them, a lot of them die. But those who survive after 5, 10, 15 years, they say, hey, you know what? We want to go home. We want to get married. We want to have kids. You know, we've gotten the adventurous streak in our blood out. Mm-hmm. And then they go home, and Saudi Arabia has 40% unemployment. The Saudis are not turning the desert green like Israel has done mm-hmm. and is doing. They're not creating industries. They're not creating employment. And the vast majority of the oil wealth goes to a very small percentage of the Saudi family. And for your information, 92% of the Saudis support ISIS. ISIS is not some kind of rogue aberration. ISIS is Saudi Arabia. ISIS is the true Islam. The king of Saudi Arabia also is seen as a collaborator with the Christian West because he sells you the oil, then he takes the money you pay him and he reinvests it back into the Western economy. So actually, the king of Saudi Arabia is guilty of corruption and helping the Christian agenda, which is really not Christian, it's the mm-hmm. one world government agenda, to stay in power and rule over the Muslims. Therefore, ISIS is saying, we will kill the king of Saudi Arabia. We will blow up the oil wells. And even we will blow up the Black Stone in Mecca. They've said it because the Black Stone in Mecca represents pre-Islamic paganism. Hmm. And there they were having homosexual acts and bestiality, sleeping with animal acts, just copulation, men and women, sacrificing their children on the altar of Molech. Hmm. All of this was done at the Black Stone. So ISIS, rightly so, says the Black Stone has to get blown up.
Hmm. And the Saudis, to that end, they've been building a high-tech border fence along Anbar province in Iraq to keep the Islamic State out.
No, it's not going to help because they're already in 92% of the Saudis support it. And these people don't have to go through across the desert. They fly. Right. They fly home. The chickens come home to roost.
Mm, mm. The book, Islamic Rivalry, you looked at the conflict between Sunni and Shia. Now, for people who may not be familiar with the differences between the two, what are those differences and what is the cause of conflict between the Sunnis and the Shias?
Well, I always say that they go by family values. What do I mean family values? You know, mafia has family turf. If you tread on the turf of another mafia family, that starts a war. That's what it is. The Shiites are the descendants of the Prophet Muhammad and his followers. The Sunnis are the descendants of the three lieutenants, Abu Bakr, Uthman, and Omar, and those three guys, the fathers of the Sunnis, represent 85% of the Muslims today. The Shiites have only 15%. The Shiites are outnumbered, and the Shiites are backed by Russia, China, North Korea, while the ISIS people, the Saudi people, the Sunnis, are backed by the United States and NATO. Guess who's going to win?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Israel's been dealing with a violent Islam for a long time.
Right, from day one.
The problem seems to have sprung up again since last fall with what some are calling the Third Intifada.
Yes.
What is going to come from this? I mean, has this strengthened the Netanyahu government? Do they have the tools? Are they approaching the problem the right way? How do you analyze that situation?
Well, what we see happening in Israel, firstly, and this is an important thing that most Americans don't understand, and I'm going to speak about this also at the conference when I talk about the Bible Bloc Party, mm-hmm. Is that Israel is a country that was founded by Soviet socialists. And when Ben-Gurion declared the independence of the state, the two first leaders to recognize Israel were President Truman and Joseph Stalin.
Hmm.
And Joseph Stalin recognized Israel because Israel was so socialist and collectivist and had so many communists in it that the Soviets expected Israel to join the Soviet bloc.
Hmm.
But what happened was Ben-Gurion was a smart man. He said, there's 6 million Jews in America. We need them too. So we're going to be neutral in the Cold War. And so the Russians went nuts. I mean, they really got so angry and they said, we're going to shift all our support over to the Arabs to destroy Israel. Stalin really hated the Jews and he hated Israel. Where were we?
Well, just how's this situation going to play out going forward?
If you go to the Knesset website and you look at the 20 elections that Israel has had since 1949, you see a steady decrease in the Soviet socialists and the liberals. You see a steady increase of maybe 2% in every election of the religious and the conservative Jewish Israelis. And actually, the political party that I'm creating, a Judeo-Christian party, will be religious and it will be conservative.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how the Orthodox or the ultra-Orthodox will accept Christians in the Knesset, but the fact is we have Muslims in the Knesset, and they're sworn to destroy us. The Christians serve in the army, pay taxes, and vote. So the general direction of Israel is to the right.
Mm.
The left is getting weaker and weaker and weaker. The war that we are facing now, this trouble, as you mentioned, the last few months, I think the Israelis have come to the understanding that every time we have some wise leader like Ehud Barak or Ehud Olmert
mm-hmm.
that come to the Arabs and say, we're going to give you everything, a war breaks out.
Because
they don't want a Palestinian state. They just want to wear us down through attrition, destroy us. They don't want a state. They just want to kill the Jews on Saturday and the Christians on Sunday.
Right.
And one of the things I'm saying is that ISIS is going to kill Jews and Christians in America and the West. And so I'm forming this party because it will be the biggest party in the Knesset. 10 million Jews and Christians are going to move to Israel, and they're going to be my people.
Hmm.
I'm going to be their party.
That is an exciting prospect.
Yes.
And it is.
Well, God is an exciting prospect.
Well, it is. I've done a little reading on the Temple Mount, and one of the things that surprised me was that during the wars that have taken place over the past 70 years, it was assumed, I think, by some of these former Soviet or socialist leaders who founded the State of Israel,
mm-hmm.
that if we give the Muslims what they want, continued access to the Temple Mount, because apparently they just viewed the Temple Mount as nothing more than an archaeological curiosity for the Jewish people, instead
right.
of the center of religious and cultural life.
Right.
How does the Netanyahu government see the Temple Mount, and what do you see coming in the future? What is the future of the Temple Mount?
Well, I have to tell you, you know, we both come from Missouri in
yes.
our own way. I've spent a lot of time in Missouri, and I was once in a church there many years ago, and a lady got up and said, when are you Jews going to build the third temple? I said, madam, we cannot build the temple. The mosques are there. We can't touch the mosque. It'll be World War III. And the pastor was sitting right behind me. He said, burn it down. Burn down the mosque. So I looked at the pastor. I said, pastor, Israel's not going to burn down the mosque. Anyways, so the point I'm saying is that the question here is, for the Muslims, not a question of should they have access or protection. The question is, they don't want Jews or Christians on the Temple Mount.
Right, right.
And I once met with the Catholic Vatican ambassador to Israel, and he said to me, if there was no temple, as now the Muslims are saying there was no temple. Years ago, they said there was a temple. Right, now they've changed the story.
Yeah.
If there was no temple,
built the first mosque right there on the Temple Mount.
Right. Yeah. If there was no temple, where did Jesus overturn the money changers' tables?
Right.
John 10, verse 22, where did Jesus go on Hanukkah? He went to the temple.
Mm-hmm.
John 10, 22. Where did he have his bar mitzvah? Remember, left behind. He had it at the temple.
Right.
So if all these things are true, what the Muslims say, that there was no temple, then the New Testament is false.
Yeah.
So this is so important. And the United Nations backs the Muslims.
Right, right. UNESCO's voting again on whether or not the
crazy.
Temple Mount is Jewish.
Completely right. Crazy. The Temple Mount is a Judeo-Christian holy place. And the only reason it's holy for the Muslims is because it's not holy. You just want to take it away and spoil it for the Jews and Christians.
Well, that speaks to the God that they serve.
Yes, the devil.
Yeah. Avi Lipkin, the author of his latest book, is Islamic Rivalry. And two fascinating talks here. You'll see these on the DVD set as well. Avi, always a pleasure. Always an education talk.
By the way, three talks.
Three talks.
And lunch. Two today, one on Sunday.
Okay. Well, my schedule's out of date.
Listen, you asked me to get up and talk about the weather. I'm going to give you 3 hours on Islamic terrorism. Bless you.
From the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference in Pikes Peak, I'm Derek Gilbert. As always, there will be links to their websites in the show notes at vftb.net. That's vftb.net. On these Wednesday evening broadcasts, just because the work week is rather busy for me at Skywatch TV, which is where I'm sitting right now. In fact, you can hear we've got a meeting going on next door. It's probably bleeding through the wall here. I will not do an awful lot of commentary to close out the program. I'll save those for the weekend podcasts. But one of the things I'm sure I'll be talking about this weekend, because it dovetails with the interview coming up this weekend, is the news that the Satanic Temple has come up with yet another, got to give them credit, brilliant marketing tactic. It's PR. The Satanic Temple is a small group of people, and at least in one interview that I've read with a friend or former friend of the co-founder, Doug Mesner, he's not actually a Satanist at all. He's an atheist, but he's using the constitutional rights guaranteed to us as Americans against Christianity by claiming the same right as a Satanist, a professing Satanist, to have his views in our schools and on public property that we Christians have sort of taken for granted over the last 240 years or thereabouts. So I give him credit. He's an intelligent guy, and his group is very savvy at getting mainstream press coverage. But I'll talk more about that this coming weekend. Sunday, the interview recorded yesterday with Tom Dunn. He's the producer and director of a new film called Detestable. Detestable. That's a reference to a passage from the book of Ezekiel, and it refers to the practice of satanic ritual abuse. I suspect that actual occultists think that people like Doug Mesner are clowns. But there is a dark undercurrent, an occult undercurrent in these United States. And Tom Dunn and Jared Crestman have gone out, collected stories of people who've endured this abuse and put it together in the film Detestable. And you will hear that Sunday on A View from the Bunker, vftb.net, and also now the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. Next Wednesday, we'll talk about history with Dr. Randall Price, an archaeologist who has worked quite often in the Holy Land. He talked about the Temple Mount and about what they might find at Qumran, which is where he'll be digging in the fall. And then filmmaker Timothy Mahoney, the director and producer of Patterns of Evidence, about the evidence for the Exodus. Got an opportunity to speak to both of those gentlemen and really appreciate their work as kind of a history geek myself. History, I don't know if you saw my presentation at the Rocky Mountain Conference or at Morningside Church, where I was allowed to deliver a longer version, almost 3 hours worth of the presentation. And archaeology play a big role in what I brought to the conference for my presentation. So it was really a delight to talk to those two guys. And that will be coming up on August the 10th. Then August 14th, filmmaker, scriptwriter, novelist, all-around Renaissance man, Brian Godawa, joins us again on A View from the Bunker. He recently attended a summit hosted by Variety Magazine on Christians in Hollywood. And he said there is hope in Hollyweird. So we'll find out what he has to say about that. And you'll hear that, God willing, on August the 14th. Our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, is back online. We were off for a couple of weeks because of the conference and the trip down to Morningside. But Sunday, you should hear 2 more hours of Bible study, 1 hour New Testament, 1 hour Old Testament. We generally get it posted by midday on Sunday, and all the studies are archived there at gilberthouse.org. We're going through both testaments in chronological order, in the order of the stories, in the order in which the stories occurred, not the order of the books in the Bible. So it gives a little different perspective on the scriptures. Again, the Gilbert House Fellowship every Sunday at gilberthouse.org. Skywatch TV, we're in the middle of a week of broadcasts featuring Dr. Michael Heiser. We not only have him on the network program, which this being Wednesday will air today on the Cornerstone Network Coast to Coast, and then also on World Harvest Television. If this is uploaded before 6 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Central Time, you'll see it on DirecTV Channel 367. That's World Harvest Television. Otherwise, you can see it also on the Skywatch TV channel on Roku, the Skywatch TV channel on Vimeo, and as an added bonus, a Skywatch TV web exclusive with Mike Heiser. We talk about the Holy Wars of Joshua, Joshua's wars against the giants during the conquest of Canaan. Mike talks about the concept of Karem. What does it mean, and why would God tell Joshua target specific groups of people and destroy everything that they owned? Kill them, kill their families, kill their livestock, burn it all, take nothing. Why did God do that? That is the program available only as a web exclusive from SkywatchTV.com or the Skywatch TV channel on Roku. And next week, Mike Heiser returns on the network program with the discussion of the Mesopotamian origin of the Watchers. And next week's web exclusive, Mike Heiser talking about the origins of demons. Again, keep your eye on SkywatchTV.com or the Skywatch TV channel on Roku for more about that. We appreciate you checking out A View from the Bunker, where however you're putting us into your ear holes, whether it's through an iPod or other MP3 player, smartphone, or what have you, wherever you catch us, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you find us, we appreciate you taking the time to give us a rating on one of those websites. Helps us show up higher in search results. And of course, if you want to discuss the topics that we discuss here on the program, join us at the View from the Bunker page on Facebook, and while you're there, give us a like. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.